First of all, a word of thanks to Wayne and to Joy for being here, and also a word of thanks to Abner too for encouragement and friendship and that generosity to help us explore our ideas and work on them together. Now, Perth is not my area. I've been working largely in 19th century cultures of mathematical physics across the Atlantic from where Perth lived. But I've been circling around Perth for years. And I recall with affection a couple of classes with Abner where we looked through a number of essays of Perth. Now, I've given a handout which I've sort of snowed you a little bit with various quotations from Perth. I thought that would be the best way to both get a bit of feel for the texture of his thought as well as give opportunity to comment on his thought. Now, I have a number of illustrations here where we... Now, here's the topics which I'll be looking at in the talk. The talk evolved somewhat from a rather dry formal talk on mathematics and Perth and its application to two initial sections, something about Perth's rather rich, complicated life. It was too much to resist commenting on. And also, I went through Abner's works, and I've just lifted out a number of places where Perth's ideas appear within his writings here. Now, Perth himself, here's Perth in the 20s in the alumni photographs. He was a rather striking, good-looking person, dressed very well. And here's Perth a little bit later on one of his trips to Europe, and that was in Germany. And then a little bit later, too, in his 50s. And then one towards the end of his life with his second wife, Juliet. He's in his 60s there. Now, there's one very powerful figure in the background of Perth's life, and it's Benjamin, his father. And I'll be returning to Benjamin a little bit in the talk. Now, just briefly regarding Perth's life, he was born in 1839 into a very classy cultured Cambridge culture, Cambridge, Massachusetts there. His father, Benjamin Perth, was a professor of mathematics at Harvard. And his mother, too, came from a well-connected line of politicians within New England. So he had a very privileged early life. An older brother, too, followed his father into being a professor of mathematics at Harvard. In one of the quotations I've given there, his father was very attentive to his early training. He shared this with John Stuart Mill and William Hamilton from very young, being given enormous attention and sort of force-fed of various ideas. And I've quoted a bit there too from Perth's later reflection. His father was very attentive to his training, taught him mathematics and taught him the rules of mathematics without giving the reasons for it. And people commented, perhaps later in life, Perth's originality of hunting out reasons, and that could go back to this early training. Then at the age of 12, 13, and he often referred to this, he found Whately's book on logic, a standard logic text of the time. And there's this nice list of topics he's given. Since that book, anything I've studied, mathematics, ethics, comparative anatomy, astronomy, phonetics, economy, men, women, wine, metrology, I have not been able to study it except as a study of semiotics. Perth has some very powerful thoughts on the nature of signs, which actually makes him sound rather postmodern. Derrida quotes Perth quite a bit in terms of his work on signs. He started working with the US Coastal and Geodetic Survey Group, and that was really the place where he did have full-time employment through to 1891. His father there was working there, and that helped Perth get a job. Now, he gave a number of early lecture series, which were well received. It was in 1879 where he got his first academic appointment, and that was at Johns Hopkins. And that lasted for about 5-6 years. It was not renewed in 1884. And the issue seemed to have been in the background. He was separated from his first wife, divorced, and he was living with someone he later married, actually a few days after the divorce finally came through. And when this word got to the president of Johns Hopkins University, this didn't go down too well, and given a different age and culture to our own. And it was not his appointment was not renewed. There. And then for a number of years, living between New York and Washington. And then finally, after his mother had died and inherited some money, he bought a property in Pennsylvania near the Delaware River. Built a house there, and that was his home base through to when he died in 1914 with cancer, which had been diagnosed in 1909. Now, I've given some quotations there which touch on this very rich, complicated life. The first is from Joseph Brent, who has a very classy biography of Peirce. And you can see in the phrasing there, this tragic life, which was brilliant, bitter, humiliating, but once was an odyssey of the spirit, which is fascinating, saddening, and compelling. And Max Fish makes the comment, too, that probably Peirce is recognized as one of the great American philosophers there, and gives this vast list, mathematician, astronomer, chemist, etc. Now, one point here, Peirce's disciplinary identity is very complicated to put down. He's known primarily for his work in logic. From my work on Peirce, mathematics competes and perhaps even dominates that. Now, a quote from Paul Weiss, one of Abner's teachers. He was irregular in his hours, forgetful in his personal appearance. This dark-bedded man of stocky build, dot, 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 could be charming. He was delightfully free, he was singularly free from academic jealousy, and he could work for 20 hours at a stretch on a subject for which he had years failed to find a producer. And then a somewhat unfair comment from Joseph Dalben. In the end, it was not his father, his left-handedness, his facial neuralgia that was to blame, but a flaw of character that allowed drugs and alcohol and rage to get the better of him or feed or excuse the constant procrastination that kept him from finishing anything. He finished a lot. However, his life was very rich, complicated. He suffered physically and with depression. And too, cocaine was used quite a bit for medical reasons in the 19th century. Towards the end of his life, morphine was very common. So, now I've got a comment here from Edward Sead, a post-colonial thinker. The exile can be seen often as the outsider in a condition of exile, different from the natives. Well, Peirce is both an insider and an outsider. But one thing about outsiders, there is a theorization that can take place between a connection between the world and theory and sign and signifier. And these dominate in Peirce's life, so there may be something to trace there. Now, regarding Peirce's scholarship, it was made complicated by the collected works, the collected papers by Hartshorne and Weiss. They put these together without too much knowledge of Peirce, certainly his mathematics, and without a historical sense. There are collections from all over Peirce. It's probably the main contact one has with Peirce now. His mathematical writings have been put together nicely by someone. Now, Peirce wrote a lot. There looks to be about 10,000 pages of his work in print. That's a lot. And in the archives is 80,000 handwritten pages. So Peirce is a difficult figure to work on. You need to get to the archive, and at the same time, it's vast there. Now, what I did is lifted out seven themes, or seven ideas I see, or mention of Peirce and Abner's writings. Now, one is Abner's inspiration from Peirce, and with good reason. Peirce is an inspiring figure. And this is a quote from the American Institute of Physics interview with Abner, and I feel somewhat awkward. Abner is here, so I'm quoting Abner directly with Abner. But Abner says, I read a lot of Peirce's papers. I loved Peirce. I love Peirce to this day. My own point of view is closer to Peirce than to anyone else. And then in the collected works, too, the reflection of how much Peirce had meant in terms of his work on phenomenology, scientific methodology, etc., and that mixture of logical toughness and immersion in the history and practices of science. Now, secondly, to on epistemology, Abner several times refers to how Peirce's work on epistemology has close resonances with his own. Yes, there's a common thread there. Now, another point is certainly the issue of emergence of laws. And Abner just briefly mentions this is a nice example of speculation that uses modern physics and merges with metaphysics. Peirce has this great idea that laws themselves can be an emergent feature of the universe. A somewhat complex idea, but it fits in. We're laws anyway, so laws need to arise somewhere. Now, the issue of proto-mentality, and I'm quoting here from Abner, that Peirce's mentalism he sees as pervasive through nature. The mentality not of a super-rational being like a god, it's like Whitehead's mentality, lower order. And it's that proto-mentality, it's the basis, the emergence of our consciousness and mentality. Now, Abner's heard me on this before, but I would raise the question whether we need this idea at the moment. Nonlinear dynamics, chaos theory, complexity theory has given us a beautiful notion of emergence. Let's simply see consciousness in an emergent property of neurological complexity, or even in a silicon environment as well. Yeah, so I'm not certain this idea of the proto-mentality now is needed. Abner also quotes Alliance 2 with Peirce on the nature of natural selection. Now, a key thing, Peirce's thought was dominated by scientific inference in exploring the nature of scientific inference. And Abner nicely lifts out some of the strengths of Peirce, his thought on those points, which I've quoted there. And the last one, I've given a great admonition of Peirce. You do not block the way of inquiry. It's a great phrase in Peirce there. Just a final critical comment there from John Smith, someone who should know Peirce. Peirce is dominated by an epistemology. And the issue being whether an epistemology based on a naturalist scientific inquiry basis actually exhausts the full reality of things. Now, Peirce would probably recognize this too. But anyway, as I said, one of the great errors of modern philosophy, and Peirce was not free of it, to see that the reality of things is exhausted by them being material for knowledge. Now, Abner has a great idea, we know, of objective indeterminacy and objective chance in terms of quantum states there. There is a nice pedigree of ideas there from Peirce through Heisenberg there, I see. And Abner refers to, Peirce has a nice notion of objective chance. Chance dominates Peirce's thought there. And I've given a quote there from Abner. And in the interview too, the AIP interview, Abner says, someone points out that link there, that reading of Heisenberg there for potentiality. Abner says, I was ripe for it, having read Peirce there. So there's a nice genealogy of ideas from Peirce to Heisenberg there. Now, I have a comment, a very general comment here, and I do it very gently. We have had the historiographic revolution of the 60s. We've had the maturing of sociology of science. We've had STS programs. Everything that's made us aware that science is local, particular set of practices at given times, given places. Now, given that, what of the project when we retrieve ideas from the past, say retrieving ideas from Peirce and from Whitehead? Just an issue there of how we do that now, given our sensitivity to local practices and cultures. They come from scientific worlds quite different from our own. So I raise it as just a question of a culture of scholarship there. Okay, now, Peirce on mathematics. First of all, the disciplinary identity issue with Peirce. Peirce speaks a lot of mathematicians rather than mathematics or mathematical. Now, the collected papers are online, so you can do some nice keyword searches. The word mathematician and mathematicians occurs 202 times. It sort of gets close, but not quite, to the use of the word mathematics. Peirce often talks about the practices and beliefs of mathematicians there. Moreover, Peirce has a pedagogical interest. He wrote three textbooks, actually. They didn't get published. Partly as an aim to make some money, and two, I would say that powerful figure of his father is in the background, the teacher of mathematics there. Now, another feature too, mathematics is foundational for Peirce. It is the first discipline we come across. It is the most general and the abstract, and they are the first sort of questions we can ask about the universe. And so it sort of has a priority there in terms of the first discipline. Well, moreover, mathematics meddles in other sciences, but it's not in the reverse direction. Yeah, mathematics, other sciences are not woven into mathematics the way mathematics is woven into other disciplines there. Pure mathematics has no need of philosophy, it has no need of logic either. And he also has a critique of logicism, that of Frege and then later of Russell. Logic is not the primary. You do not reduce mathematics to logic. Rather, mathematics stands by its own without any need of any other discipline to justify itself. Now, the third point, mathematics is the science that draws necessary conclusions. Now, he gets this definition from his father, Benjamin Peirce. Yeah, so it's the very process of drawing necessary conclusions that's central to mathematics. And moreover, the mathematician creates hypotheses. It is a study of hypothetical things which constitute mathematics. And moreover, mathematics certainty comes from its hypothetical nature. That's one feature where certainty comes from mathematics there. And mathematics, as I quote there, studies nothing but pure hypotheses there. Moreover, all thought that is exact is mathematical. There's a sort of pan-mathematical spirit in Peirce. The doctrine of exact philosophy, as I understand it, is that all danger of error in philosophy can be reduced by treating it problems as mathematical problems there. Philosophy requires exact thought, and all exact thought is mathematics. All necessary reasoning is, in a sense, mathematical reasoning. Rather significant part of his notion of mathematics and exact thought. And he refers rather positively to George Crystal's definition in one of the encyclopedias. Crystal was one of Maxwell's students. Mathematics studies concepts which can be definite in particular there. The other feature, part five, mathematics is to do with diagrams and observations. And this is Peirce's semiotics here. You reason with diagrams. You form a diagram of a state of things. You perceive the different parts of the diagram. And moreover, this is a significant phrase, you perceive parts of the diagram that were not explicit in the definition. He's following Kant here. Mathematics is synthetic, not analytic. So the way you do mathematics is sort of that mental experimentation on diagrams. And this is primarily, obviously, true of geometry, but it's also true of algebra. The symbols of algebra you reason on in a similar way. So I've given various quotes there where this is very expressed very strongly in Peirce there. How it works. Moreover, too, mathematics has its dimension of observation. Now, this comes out rather strikingly. And it's actually from Sylvester. Sylvester gave a talk to the British Association in 69, where he made that point very strongly, quoting Gauss, that mathematics involves observation. Now, for Peirce, it's the observation of those mental diagrams that forms the dimension of observation there. Okay, so there's that feature of mathematics being very closely tied into the manipulation of diagrams and observations there. And as I said at the bottom here, in other words, the observation of diagrams and alike is an essential part of mathematics. Now, I've given an aside there. Peirce was left-handed, and there's been a little bit of speculation about this, and I quote from that recent biography. Recent research supports Peirce's notion that left-handeders are different. And he quotes a psychologist there, has placed this trait in the context of recent studies of brain hemisphere dominance and points to the similarity of Einstein and Peirce in their visual and diagrammatic way of thinking, and suggests that the ability of both to use the imaging hemispheres to create the visual language of thought experiments. So anyway, it's an intriguing aside on Peirce's. Peirce did comment a little bit on his left-handedness. Now, there's an issue about making errors in mathematics. Peirce's general philosophy has a spirit of fallibilism, that our hypotheses about nature and the world are always liable to correction. It is a feature of all knowledge. Mathematics, though, has a certainty about it, a necessity about it. So there's some complex phrases in Peirce where he's circling around this issue. Mathematicians make errors. Well, how they correct them, they get together, they see the error, it's corrected immediately, they don't need logic nor philosophy to help them there. So there's an issue there about it being infallible, certain, necessary. There that Peirce returns to quite a bit. I've given a comment here. Peirce has a resonance with the Scottish philosopher Dougal Stewart, that mathematics is based on arbitrary hypotheses that you make. And then you deduce consequences from hypotheses. Now, this was opposed very strongly, at least Dougal was, by William Whewell. Whewell wanted to ground the truths of mathematics into the nature of reality, into some metaphysical foundation. So in some senses, a nice sort of non-foundational sense of mathematics here. You create the hypotheses. You don't ground them in the nature of intuitions like Kant or anything else. And on that basis, you draw consequences there. And this also fits a hypothetical interpretation, which logicians make a good bit of. And it's the interpretation of the universal all A are B, and if A, then B. The first one is true if there is no A. There is no class of the letter represented by A. And the second one is always true if the proposition A is false, a definite modern hypothetical interpretation. So in one sense, I've got a comment here. There's a sort of post-foundationalism there in Peirce. Now, people have commented, you see this also in Peirce, James, and Dewey. There's a sort of post-foundational, or there's not a need to ground things in foundations that you find across the Atlantic in the European thought. And people, the social contextualists, have brought out that nice point. In the culture of the Americas, you have a frontier culture, very different to a European culture. And the issue of searching and grounding foundations is not the same necessity. Peirce does celebrate a Platonic sense of mathematics, but it's not an ontological type of sense, just that mathematics is a world of pure potential being, which is that. Represents a Platonic world in some sense. Now, part four here, on the relationship between mathematics and nature. Now, the key figure in the background here is his father, I would think. Anyway, it's something I discovered, or at least people commented on it a little bit. Benjamin Peirce was a very powerful, charismatic figure and I've quoted here from one of these biographies, with almost a Pythagorean prayer about mathematics. It's woven deeply into the nature of reality there. And it's done so in a spiritual sense. And Charles refers to it as sort of a fusion of mind and nature. And Emerson refers to Peirce seeing mathematics there is shining into the background of space. And a quote there from Peirce himself, where he sees within nature the exact law of numbers there. In the graceful features of nature, you see the repulsive wrinkles of algebra. His father certainly had a turn of phrase. So in various places within his father's thought, you see this just sort of almost mystical fusion of mathematics and nature being woven together as a given. And I've given that a quote there too. He refers to this illustrious equation of Lagrange. And it's actually, I noticed the equation on this, on the board here in this, from this photograph of Peirce. And Peirce says, yes, once you have that equation, all that remains for the mathematician is to pass through his ideal alembics and give it a just interpretation there within nature. Now, this is enormously influential, I think, in the work of Charles Peirce as well. Now, I have a link here to Adner, Wegener's famous essay, The Unreasonable Effectiveness of Mathematics in the Natural Sciences. Wegener refers to one of Peirce's ideas in the middle of that essay, and he thanks Adner for the origins of that idea of Peirce. Now, this is one of the big themes in philosophy of mathematics and philosophy of physics. How do you put together the abstract, the formal, the necessity, the symbolic with the concrete, the particular, contingent, and the physical? In an old theme. Now, Peirce sort of circles around this in an interesting way. And I've given various quotations here. He stresses that the mathematician lives in another world than the world of the physical, of the scientist there. It's a world of pure forms there. But then there's a little hint, yet, what would steam engines, electric cables, insurance tables, a thousand things be, but for the hints which the mathematicians have given us? And then another phrase, there's no essential difference between pure and applied mathematics. There, the difference being that the hypotheses that the mathematician deals with are not taken to be any way relevant to the world there. And I've given that phrase, these hypotheses are more or less suggested by observation. If they're crabbed and one-sided in the interest of truth, it is applied mathematics there. And then I've given a quote later on there, and I've highlighted a little bit there, that the mathematicians and physicists have been coming together for the last decade and compare their problems there. And it is realized that certain physical problems are at a standstill for want of appropriate mathematics there. And then there's a phrase, the complex plane is one of the meeting grounds of mathematicians and physicists there. It's a significant image in mathematicians and physicists meet together using an issue of the practices of both. And then another phrase that sounds very much like his father's thought there. I doubt that either Cayley or Sylvester would regret to see the sway of the Virgin Queen thus extended over new domains. And regarding that harmony of nature and the world of the intellect, what God has joined together, let no man put asunder. There. So, the issue, the truths of mathematics are ideal. Those which are in physics are applied. Applied mathematics is simply the study of an idea as it has been constructed to look more or less like nature there. Now, he does consider particular applications, one being geometry. It was a discussion, too, of non-Euclidean geometry. The nature of geometry of the world is a matter of observation requiring philosophy, in naturalized philosophy. He also speculates about more dimensions, and this was a little bit in the air at the time, the late 19th century. The higher dimensions, a lot of spiritualist movement too, of the speculation of four dimensions there. And there's a nice phrase there too about objects. We may have a three-dimensional world, but who's to say in the microscopic world there may be just a particle wiggling in the fourth dimension? In being the Perimeter Institute, I couldn't resist mentioning that little bit there. He also refers to quaternions a little bit, which was celebrated as being the new physical insight into reality a few decades before Peirce. Now, on dimensionality, too, there's a nice sort of resonance with Whitehead. Various parts of Whitehead will speculate on possibilities, higher dimensions. We just happen at the moment to be living in an epoch of three dimensions, which I quoted there. Okay, so in various ways, Peirce doesn't quite solve this issue of putting together mathematics and physics. There are two parallel streams he puts together there. Now, what I've done here towards the end of this meeting point between mathematics and physics, he had lifted out three or four different possibilities you can see in Peirce. Now, one is mathematics as a map when applied to physical reality. And this is the solution here. And it's looking at mathematics as a form of representation. And mathematics is a map. So within the map of mathematics, the particular relationships, the features of the mathematics map, as maps do, to features of particular physical reality. So the image of mathematics is a map. One thing to do with the relationship between mathematics and physical reality. Now, another way, Percival also blurred the distinction between mathematics and scientific reasoning, even though he keeps them rather distinct. Both use diagrams and signs and their observations. Theirs is semiotics. And both reason by experimentation on diagrams. Moreover, Peirce stresses scientific knowledge is hypothetical, not substance for belief, actually, in an interesting way, which Dewey will certainly take science as substance for belief in terms of pragmatism. I've given a quote there. Nothing is vital for science. Nothing can be. The scientific man is not the least wedded to his conclusions. He risks nothing upon them. He stands ready to abandon all of them. This sounds very much like Karl Popper. They may be refuted tomorrow. So in one sense, the hypotheses of mathematics take this hypothetical state, somewhat like mathematics, there. Then this is very similar to position in someone who's argued Daniel Campus in a doctoral thesis recently. I would claim that for Peirce, the most important application of mathematics does not consist in the deployment of this or that particular mathematical theory, but in the overall employment of necessary reasoning to investigate problems. So there's another perspective there on the relationship of mathematics to nature. And what it is, it's a focus onto the practices of the mathematician and scientist. So instead of worrying about the more formal issue of representation of symbol to reality, you focus on the very practice of the mathematician, the very practice of the scientist. And it's in their practices that one is looking at a relationship between mathematics and nature. And if you were someone like Rorty, you would claim, we got captivated by Western thought into worrying about representation. Let's drop it and let's look at practices far more. So Peirce has a rather rich notion there. You focus on the type of thinking of the mathematician, the type of thinking of the scientist. And certainly all exact thought of the scientist will have a mathematical dimension. So it's a way of putting together the relationship of mathematics and nature that somewhat circumvents the issue of representation. This old issue of sort of seeing how we can map these two worlds together. And in that sense, too, it makes it somewhat modern. Ian Hacking has this nice text on realism. He talks about representation and intervention. And he says, sure, we can worry about how our thoughts represent the world, this old image of the mind representing reality. We can also look at the practices of scientists and look at the way they experiment and intervene in the world. There's a way of putting together thought and reality. And it's got a distinct sort of pragmatist flavor to it, which puts it at odds to other traditions within philosophy. So folks, there is that thread within Peirce's notion of mathematical thinking, which stresses its necessary nature, its certainty, its hypothetical, it's the foundational discipline. And then it's the world of potential form of the Platonic world. And then sort of these two ways of putting together mathematics with the practice of the world. So thank you.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And that's a good tension. This Peirce has a way of talking about mathematics is it's something that the mathematician does it instinctively. It's like learning to speak before you know grammar. And it's, and hence, there's where his sort of bit of the reverse logicism comes in. And it's also in that logic text by Whatley, too, there's a stress, a very similar stress that we know how to reason instinctively. It's only later on we get to work to look at how we reason. So I think that's a strong thread in Peirce, where he always keeps it to the foreground. The mathematician just does it. The mathematician does not need to know how one reasons. And logic, you know, that claim that logic doesn't, if two mathematicians disagree, they will work it out without drawing on logic and philosophy. Yes, that would fit, yes, yes. Yes, I think, I think so, yes, yeah, right. Abner may be able to comment. Within Whitehead, too, there's a notion of habit. Within Whitehead's thought, there's a notion of habit, is it? Sorry, could you say? Yes, the laws of nature are habits of nature. Could there be resonances with Peirce there? Did Peirce? Yes. Yeah, that's enough. Yes. Praise. Yes. 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 Yeah. And it seems that, yeah. It seems to it's a nice way to look at the problematic status of the ontology of laws, the very nature of a law itself. Where are laws of nature? If one looks at them as nothing but capturing the behavior of matter, until one has matter around, there are no laws of nature. So it's an issue. How did nature know, you know, that after a certain inflationary period, that it was to solidify into four basic interactions? Yes. 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 And just thinking about it now, too, the focus on the habit, too, also picks up the focus on practice. It's not so much mathematics, but it's the practice of the mathematician, the practice of the scientist. First is dominated by an epistemology. It's the prime discipline for Peirce. He's always concerned with the nature of thinking, his own thinking. And I suspect there could be some interesting link then between that notion of habit, of solidifying laws, looking at the practice of the universe in some general way with the practice of, the focus on the practices of the scientist and the mathematician there, so. Yes, Adam. Sequences, yes. Yes. Interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that seems a good issue. And I mean, he, as you know, he spent a lot of time on terms of Cantor's idea of, you know, the infinite sets and non-denumerability. And that, so there is a good issue there. I'd need to explore Peirce a lot further. Yes. Yeah.
Well, I think the lawyer, for example, when you get it, especially on the national numbers, that's what you're going to solve.
Yeah, I wonder.
It's just a marvelous, logical, mathematical reasoning of very much concern rigor in mathematics. And the idea that, well, mathematics doesn't really need logic, and it's hard to see that in the light of those developments, even regardless of particular partners.
Yeah. Yes, and I'm not too familiar enough to know the details there. But it is surprising the way he does keep returning to mathematics as being foundational. I mean, I'd even do some psychohistory here too. I mean, the strength of his father, he first talks about it. You know, Peirce's known primary is work in logic. But Peirce himself keeps returning to this powerful foundational notion of mathematics. Throughout his whole life, really, and celebrates it. So I'm not certain on that. Now, as you know, too, there's that priority dispute on logic between the quantifiers with Frege. It's almost about the same time, you know, the universal and existential quantifier in the 80s when he's at Johns Hopkins. Yeah. He has a quote there. Yeah. Yeah. Which page is this, Wayne? Yes. Yeah, that's a problem. Yes. Yeah, that's a good point. He's yes. He's rather critical too of Russell and the, you know, the project of the logicism of Russell. Very critical. Abner, how much is it influenced by his semiotics? How much is Peirce's thinking influenced by his semiotics? The theory of signs, all thinking for Peirce is diagrammatic in science. How much is Peirce dominated by his theory of sign and semiotics? He had an awful lot. And certainly on his semiotics, he sounds very modern. I mean, this raises a lot of interesting issues in terms of the nature of thinking. And also, I read Derrida late at night, and there's some nice resonances between Derrida and Peirce. I'm not quite certain what Peirce would think of Derrida, but at least there's some nice link-ups there. Yeah, that's insane. And Peirce several times makes the distinction between draws and drawing. The mathematician, the mathematician draws inferences, while the logician is concerned with drawing. It's a confusing and subtle distinction, but he makes it several times. And I think it's back to the idea that mathematics works intuitively, naturally. The mathematician just does it. While the logician is concerned with the details and the very drawing on the inference, not just the practice. Yeah, so. Fine, thank you. Thanks.